Welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast. My name is Rebecca Higgy, and today I'm talking to author John Doust and Fremantle Press publisher Georgia Richter about John's new novel, Return Ticket, the final book in his One Boy's Journey to Man trilogy. Settle in as we talk about everything from racism to masculinity, and stay tuned for insights on the writer and editor relationship and what it's been like for John and Georgia to work with one another for over a decade. Most importantly, prepare yourselves, listeners, as we delve into the dirtiest of topics, the dishes. John Doust is best known as a writer, professional speaker, big ideas inspirer, and community projects facilitator. He is the author of three novels, Boy on a Wire, which was longlisted for the Miles Franklin Literary Award, To the Highlands, and Return Ticket. Georgia Richter has taught creative writing, professional writing and editing at the universities of Melbourne, Western Australia and Curtin. She has been with Fremantle Press since 2008 and is the fiction, creative nonfiction and poetry publisher. John, Georgia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Excellent. All right. John, let's start with some context. What is Return Ticket about?
Oh, the big question. What's it about? It's about, well, of course, the thing is, there were two books before. The first book was about the boy, how the boy started, how his life started, what impacted him, what set him up, if you like. And then the second book, To the Highlands, was about the fall of the young man. There's all this crashes down on him and crushes him. And then this Return Ticket is about how Jack Muir, my twin brother, how he goes out to get away from himself, really, to seek the other, and the other being the other bits of him and the other bits of the world, and so he climbs and he falls and he climbs. He travels through South Africa, he gets caught up in all sorts of stuff, and then he flees to Israel where things change, things happen. He returns to his moral core, I think. And then it's back and forth between communal farming settlements of Israel, the kibbutzim, and Australia, and marriages, and it's an adventure in the world outside of Jack Muir, but also inside of Jack Muir, and it's how Jack becomes a man.
Mm. So I've read all three in the trilogy.
You're okay.
I am okay.
Right?
I did read them very quickly, so.
Probably too quickly.
Maybe. When I got to the end of Boy on a Wire, I saw there was a list where all the boys of the boarding school end up. So this made me think you didn't initially plan to write a trilogy. So what changed?
Well, I changed. I think I'd always intended writing a book set in Israel because the life on the kibbutz had such an impact on me. Hmm. It was always in my mind to write, and I think I just realised that there were other bits of my life had been too adventurous not to dredge, not to set up a floating platform and send down pipes and drills and bring it all the sludge to the surface. So then it seemed that there were three. It's three. Just I like three as a number. Mm. Three's an important number in comedy, and three seems to have been an important number in my life. So it had to be. It had to be three. But along the way, I got confused and thought there were four. So there's one book in between that died. And now I finished up back where I started, which was with three. I had to bring Jack to a point where he was a human being, where he was a rounded, where he achieved what Carl Jung would call individuation, where he achieved a kind of wholeness.
I think it's really interesting that this could potentially have been four books. I wonder, Georgia, did you have any kind of discussions with John about the trilogy and whether it was better to be a trilogy or if it was a four thing?
It's interesting, yes. At some point John said to me, actually this trilogy is four books, which, you know, sort of aligned with John's sense of humour. But once I got on top of that, he did then show me the book that slotted in before Israel. And we had many discussions over, I think it was probably a few years, John, as I recall. And essentially in the South African book, which was a whole book, I think eventually I concluded, and hopefully John concluded with me, that Jack Muir was, in fact, reiterating what he'd already done and where he'd already been into the Highlands. Mm. And he wasn't moving on. He was still kind of stuck. So it felt like a shift had to occur. And that's when the whole South African book was condensed into the beginning of what became Return Ticket.
There are, John, you mentioned getting all the sludge up. Now, there are a lot of themes in this book. So racism, socialism, war, colonialism, masculinity, love, family. But so let's start with love. Jack finally finds someone to love and love him back. So why do you think this relationship is different, and why does it work when others failed?
I think it's funny because for me also a very important thread in To the Highlands is love.
Mm.
Because in To the Highlands, Jack loves two women.
Mm.
One is an unrequited love. Love is a pure love. It's Jack's love for a Madonna-like character.
Mm.
And for me, the love was a very important thread in the second book, but a lot of readers missed the love because of all the other stuff. Also, for me, that third book that didn't become a book, I got caught up in the adventures. Somehow, at some point, I think I thought I was Robert Ruark or one of those guys who write rampaging adventures through Africa. I think I got caught up too much in the violence and the adventurism of it all, and I forgot Jack Muir's story, which was the beginning, the fall, and the coming together, and which is pretty much what Georgia said. We weren't getting Jack anywhere. We weren't getting him to the point. And the other thing, of course, was to bring Jack to the now, and so the book doesn't Return Ticket doesn't finish until 2018. So it's right up until just before Jack passes on. But the love, love is, I think, Jack, and certainly for me, I think one of the forces driving me away from the place I grew up in was driving me away from family, from the society, from the old school chums that I grew up in, was that I couldn't find love. I couldn't find the kind of love that I was seeking. There was something lacking. There was something missing. I couldn't find it. And so, love is a crucial part of the wholeness. If you don't love, you're not whole, I think.
Mm.
Is that an answer?
Yes, it is, yes. I think it's also, when you talked about the three books, that there's kind of this third book that's kind of the redemption, and it makes sense that redemption and love kind of go hand in hand.
Jack's my twin brother. I had to bring Jack to a point where he was more like me now rather than like the me before, if you know what I mean. I had to bring Jack back to his moral core, to his original self, where he rants against injustice, against humanity, where he's a pure, whole, vegetarian, vegan, environmentalist.
Mm. It was interesting having read the book so quickly, seeing the transformation. I don't think the Jack in the third book would really know the Jack in the first book.
No.
Mm.
No, I think that's it. You're absolutely correct. And at the end, we might read a piece that kind of alludes to that.
Mm. I'd love to talk more about the author and editor relationship. So, Georgia, starting with you, how do you see your role as an editor in the kind of author-editor relationship?
Essentially, the editor's role is to honour the author's vision. And what's interesting with an editorial relationship is that trust is required, but trust comes from working together. So you hope those things coalesce quite quickly. But without trust, things are difficult to be received. I think the editor needs to be as excited about the manuscript as the author is. Without that, then there's no point. And it's a shared vision, but the editor's role is to honour that author's vision. And the editor's role is also to say when it's not working. And I think in those conversations we had along the way, occasionally and intermittently, I found that just as hard to say as John did to receive. But I felt, and I mean that, John, it was tough. And I felt your pain because I knew that what I was saying meant I knew how much work you'd put into it already and how much time that had meant. And I was saying, oh, back to the drawing board, John, here we go again. And that seemed like something that I could, a line I could throw at you lightly, but I wasn't throwing it at you lightly at all. And it was tough to say, but it was also important to say.
So, John, how do you work with Georgia in the creation of these books?
I just sit back and await further instructions.
I imagine you're the editor's dream then, if you're just awaiting instruction.
I think George is right. I think trust is absolutely crucial, and every comment I took deep, and there was always, because ultimately, like George, I want the work to be as good as it can possibly be. Know that this book is a result of this partnership. The three books are a result of the partnership. It's not. I couldn't say that I couldn't do it with anybody else because I'd never worked with anybody else. But I'm quite sure I couldn't do it with anybody else. I think that the trust that we and the relationship that we worked out with the first book stood us in fine stead through all three, because there's trust, there's great respect, and whatever instructions came back, whatever suggestions, I took each and every one of them as a challenge, and as soon as I received the notes, I would immediately begin work with an intense discipline that is not usual in my normal life.
Do you think your relationship with one another's changed over the decade that you've worked together?
I think only my respect and trust has deepened.
Georgia?
Oh, John, that's a very nice thing to say. I was thinking back to when I first met you, and in fact your manuscript was the very first manuscript I edited for Fremantle Press and as a freelancer just before I came on board. So it was an absolute sort of foundation, the beginning of my career at Fremantle Press, which is very significant in itself. But I remember meeting you at a cafe in Fremantle and how much I laughed. And I think, and I was thinking about that, I think if you can laugh together, you can work together, basically. And then the growing trust over time makes it easier to sort of navigate the hard bits. But I think the other thing is that over 10 years, a lot of life also happens as well. And I know that a lot of life happened to you and to me in that time. And it's impossible as you work together to ignore the life that is happening around you. And it's important to pay heed to where you were at or I was at any given moment. And I think we both did that. And I think the other thing is that as I grew to know you more, it also helped me understand why John Doust is not Jack Muir, even though at times it felt like you were writing a memoir, but I also knew that you weren't and that we were working on a novel. And I think it's just that kind of richness over time that enables the books to emerge.
John, your trilogy is called One Boy's Journey to Man. Masculinity is a key theme in all three books. Can you talk a little bit about Jack's relationship with masculinity and how it develops?
Yes, well, Jack, of course, starts his life in a country town that is dominated by men, in a family that is dominated by a single man. He has two other brothers. He has a mother. It's only alluded to in the first book, but clearly his mother has some kind of mental health issue. And Jack does his best to be sent to a boarding school. He does his damnedest to be a man like all other men. He wants to be the phantom. He wants to crush the evils. As I often say to people, his two superheroes were Jesus and the Phantom. They operated in much the same way, except that if you upset Jesus, he would forgive you. If you upset the Phantom, he would leave a mark on your jaw. It's the only difference between the two. And then, of course, he goes off to Papua New Guinea and he tries to be that kind of a man, you know, the rampant sexing man, the the dominant man, but he doesn't quite, he never quite makes it. And it's all terribly confusing. It's horrible. And then in To the Ticket, what is it? What's the book called? Return Ticket. To the Ticket.
That's the one.
He tries to bring it all together. And I think my view of masculinity is that it's about wholeness. It's about, and often when I think of masculinity, I think of the so-called five good Roman emperors, of which four in particular were really the kinds of men that I looked to. The first was the fellow called Nerva, who was really just a bureaucrat. The next fellow was a fellow called Trajan. And so from Trajan to Hadrian to Antoninus Pius and Marcus Aurelius, these four guys were all very manly men. They were warriors. They were champion athletes, but they were also had an artistic temperament. They had the hardness and the softness. They had the masculine and the feminine. They were whole. They were of their time, of course. So they were brutal and nasty and so on. But they had a wholeness about them, and all of them were bisexual or rampantly homosexual or a little bit bisexual. So they embraced a kind of everything. If you know what I mean. And when I think of masculinity, I think that a real, a real man is a man who embraces the hard and the soft and knows when to lead and when not to lead. He knows when to. I remember my father when my mother, he was the primary care for my mother. My father was a very manly man. And he'd have to wash her and clean her, and he handled her very roughly. And I remember, I got to the house one day just after he'd washed her, and he picked her up out of her wheelchair and he threw her on the bed. And I said, "Dad, she's not a bag of spuds."
And how did he respond to that?
He of course laughed because he had a good sense of humour, but. It wasn't long after that that he himself crumbled, and we then had to care for him. I think that in over time, and he left us a letter before he went, and we know because of the letter that he saw new ways in his four sons. He saw new ways of being a man that he hadn't been able to accomplish himself.
That's interesting, the idea that the father can learn about masculinity through his sons.
Well, it's one of the questions I asked my son. I continue to ask him. His son is now four, and about once every 18 months I say to him, what have you learned from your son this last year? What have you learned from your son? Because I made it very clear to him that I learned so much about myself through him.
Georgia, were there conversations with John where you specifically teased out these issues to do with masculinity?
Yeah, there were a couple. I think when I think of To the Highlands, that was perhaps one of the biggest challenges because Jack Muir there is inhabiting a contemporary voice in 1968. So it had to be a voice of his time.
Yeah.
But we also had to let the reader know that we knew.
Yes.
So we had to balance the sense that there were all sorts of racist, sexist, colonialist attitudes in operation, but we knew, and the reader should not equate the author with the character
of the time.
And the way we framed that up was to get a few professional references at the beginning of the book in the form of some letters from a medico and a psych to show that, you know, Jack in fact was aware, and as John said earlier, was sort of never quite making it and was troubled almost by what he was inhabiting. I think it was a lot easier then in Return Ticket because old Jack Muir is a lot more enlightened than young Jack Muir, so we could use old Jack Muir, we could deploy him to talk through some of those issues when young Jack Muir was failing to get it.
Yeah.
And that was really helpful. And so I think just in Return Ticket, there were occasions when I said to John, say if it was something to do with the male gaze or, you know, discussions about abortion or those kind of flashpoint topics, do you mean to enrage the reader at this point?
Mm.
And sometimes John said no and sometimes he said yes. And when he said yes, then it stayed.
Mm.
And when he said no, then sometimes we revisited that.
Well, I would love to talk to you about the kind of the colonialism and racism that comes up a lot in the book. In Return Ticket, there are a few scenes where Jack imagines himself as the hero, where he's rebelling against the system in ways like standing in the coloured line at the post office in South Africa. John, I wonder, what does Jack teach us about how some white people think about themselves and their place in a racist world?
I think the thing about Return Ticket is that we've got Jack back to his anger at injustice, and of course, if someone just reads Return Ticket without reading To the Highlands, they won't necessarily know that Jack has been in love with women from other places with a dramatically different skin tone.
Mm.
I think what Jack and I both want the reader to be aware of is that we all belong to the same race. And if you walk into a post office, for example, and there's a parcel queue, why wouldn't you stand in the parcel queue?
Mm.
Why is there a parcel queue for a group of people at one skin tone and another parcel queue for people of another skin tone? It doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous. And I think also that one of the important themes in my life has been to get through all these splits of no assistance whatsoever. And so in casual conversation, I'll say to people, you know, what do you mean black and white? What are you saying? They're of no assistance whatsoever. So I think what Jack wants, and then of course he goes to Israel, and he finds these isms in every place he goes, because Israel, although it's seemingly, yes, a Jewish state, but there are people of different skin tones there.
Yeah.
There are people, Falashas from Africa. There are dark-skinned people from Yemen. They're all Jewish.
Mm.
And then there's, you've got so many overlays that people, for whatever reason, separate us into. So there's black and white, there's Jew and Arab, there's Persian and Arab, there's Kurd and Turk and if these are about respecting different cultures, then I think they can be helpful. But if they're about denigration, if they're about diminishing, then I don't think they're of any assistance to us whatsoever. And it's in Jack's later life, for example, in Return Ticket, Jack lives in a place called Kinkanup, and one of the important aspects of Jack's homecoming is that he comes home to Noongar country, and Kinkanup, of course, is the first recorded name for Albany.
At some point when Jack's in South Africa at the height of apartheid, he observes that, and my quote here is, all players, the oppressors, the oppressed, bystanders, visitors, become victims. So I'd love to know what you meant by that.
Well, they are. Everyone's a victim. If you think of a place that I spent a lot of my life in, Israel, I lived on a community next to Gaza, and they're both victims. There are people in the community there who want there to be a Palestinian state. I've got friends in that community who call all this the Palestinian War of Independence, and yet they can they're kind of helpless. They're still in contact with their friends in Gaza, but another piece of Gaza is sending rockets into the community. Fires have started in the community because of rockets. And at the same time, other people within the state of Israel are sending rockets back the other way.
Yeah.
And so both these players are victims. Wherever you go, you've only got to think of the inhumanity that is revealed. A wonderful example at the moment is what's going on with Burma and the Rohingya. There we had this wonderful human being who was such a campaigner for democracy in Burma. And she's recently addressed the United Nations because the Rohingya are being brutalized. Mm. And we're all stunned that this amazing human being it seems powerless to do anything about this. So she is now a victim, because if she is the human being that we thought she was, she must be living in intense pain.
Mm.
And if she isn't, then the pain continues. There is no lessening of the pain, and we're in pain because we believed in her. So we all, in the end, we're all victims.
Yeah, it actually made me think about how often you think about colonialists or the colonial kind of project. Those who are actually colonizing places were really not only brutalizing others, but becoming kind of these monsters that go and invade other places, take over other people. So when I read that quote, it made me think about how even in the act of being brutal, we lose a part of our humanity.
Absolutely. And a lot of people think, I think one of the problems with the word colonialism is that we think in terms of Great Britain, we think France, we think Portugal, we think Spain, we think the Netherlands, but of course there are still colonial empires in the world now.
Mm.
Indonesia is a colonial empire of the Javanese, China is a colonial empire of the Hun, and so on. We can go right through a whole range of places.
Mm.
And I particularly feel the pain of the West Papuans at the moment, because having spent some time on the other side in Papua New Guinea, in a place that was at that point, because I was there before independence, that was then a colony of Australia. And one of the driving forces to write that book was that anything I'd ever read about Papua New Guinea was very twee and very nice. We had the sense that we were nice colonialists. We weren't as bad as the others.
Mm.
But no, I'm sorry. We were colonialists. We were there. We did brutal, horrible things, and we took what we wanted when we wanted it. And we were only there because there was stuff there that we wanted, and we wanted it then. So we took it.
Mm.
And of course, that's what's happening on the other side now in West Papua. It's monstrous, and it continues right around the planet. It's not over. It's not ended.
No. Dare I make a joke when we're talking about something so seriously? But would it be fair to say that some authors feel that the editor-author relationship is one of oppressor and victim, dare I ask?
It's quite possible. I'm the sort of person that I am. I'm also an agitator. I'm agitated, and I'm an agitator.
Mm.
I don't live easily in a community. My wife says that it's very difficult to holiday with me because I don't holiday easily. I'm so damn curious. I want to know the entire history of a place. I want to find error and everything I possibly can. I don't live easily in a town. I have to do things. Mm. I could not work with such an editor. There are some people I know who don't have satisfactory relationship with editors. I understand that. That couldn't happen to me because I wouldn't last.
Mm. I don't think the editor would last either. Georgia, what would you say?
Well, I think John is last of the great egalitarians. If you've ever had the experience of walking about the town with John, you cannot get five paces before the next person launches themselves at you and identifies his relationship to them, which I love. You know, I think that's an amazing quality. I too have heard of this phenomenon but have never experienced it. And I think partly that editors like GPs should do no harm. That should be the foundation principle.
Nice.
But I think the other foundation principle is that the editor should be really excited about the work, and that's what's at the heart of that relationship. And so effectively what you have is two wordsmiths, and it doesn't matter what the personalities are. And I think the vivacious – I've actually never met an editor with the personality of John, but perhaps such a thing exists. But the vivacious writer and the calm editor are a fine match, and the shared vision is what's really important.
So I'd love to talk more about this, the editor, the author, but and also about writing, particularly any advice the two of you would have for emerging writers like myself. Now let's start with the dishes. So in this book, Jack has a really lovely obsession with doing the dishes. First off, John, are you like this? Do you love doing the dishes?
Yes, I do. We have a dishwasher, and it's lucky if it gets one run a week.
Yep.
I do love washing dishes. I've washed dishes on a lot of continents. I well remember washing dishes on both kibbutzim. I live in Israel, in which I lived in both those communities, and I would wash dishes wearing rubber boots and Speedos and a big rubber apron.
That's quite an image.
This is before Speedos had taken over the world of swimming.
Mm.
So they were quite unique. Nobody else wore anything like them.
In fact, John, they originated in the world of dishwashing.
Somebody spotted me in them and photographed them and then stole them. So, this is where the writing, this is a tip for writers.
Mm.
I'm not, it's Jack isn't me and I'm not Jack, although I'm very, very fond of him Jack has helped me grow, and I've helped Jack achieve this place that he's in now. But Jack washes dishes not quite like me, but I've changed my dishwashing style since Jack. So what I did was, once I got onto this dishwashing thing, I paid very, very close attention to how I wash dishes. And then I created a way of washing dishes for Jack.
Mm.
And so Jack, I now wash dishes like Jack.
That's really interesting.
I didn't used to wash dishes like Jack.
But now you do.
Jack has transformed my dishwashing technique.
Georgia, what advice would you have for emerging writers looking to develop authentic characters?
When I'm going through the slush pile and I pick up a manuscript, I heave a deep inward sigh when I encounter a description of someone's hair and eyes in the first paragraph.
Mm.
And I was wondering why that was, but I think it's actually because the detail that you look for, the distinguishing detail, is not found in adjectives so much as it's found in habits and turns of phrase and
behaviour.
Yeah. Exactly. And that must come from the writer, as John says, really understanding and inhabiting the character. And I think if the writer can't do that, the reader won't also.
Mm.
But by the same token, if you give the reader too much, which if you give them the hair and the eyes, you're actually leaving them nothing to do.
Mm.
So you want them to be able to imagine what someone looks like by what they say, rather than because you're just handed on a platter
they've got blue eyes.
Their description.
Yeah.
That's right.
Are there any protocols for first accepting and then editing manuscripts that talk about race politics but which aren't own voice stories?
I think this is an issue which is very pertinent to now, and I think that may change again, you know, in 100 years or whatever, but right now I think it's something that editors must and should be sensitive to. And I think that's because we're really only just beginning to look at the wounds that we've created, and everything is very tender
in the
wounds of colonisation, the damage we cause, and therefore appropriation, I think it's important to be sensitive to that. So when I read a manuscript that is appropriating someone else's voice, and particularly in, say, an Indigenous Australian context, then if they're inhabiting that voice, generally I will say, is there another way to do this? Because it just doesn't feel right at this time. And it's important also to talk to the writer about what they've done and who they've talked to, and then as an editor to do your due diligence, to consult wherever there is a feeling of unease or a sense of this does need other eyes and other positions. It needs to be considered from with other eyes and from other positions. And I think that is certainly one of the responsibilities of editors at this time in history.
Mm.
Here and there.
Can I add to that?
Please, go ahead.
I was blessed with having a grandfather who spoke Noongar, and as does Jack, funnily enough. Mm. Pure coincidence, of course.
Of course.
Before I used the word kinkanup, I sat down with four of my Noongar Manang friends, and I said, I don't want to call this place that Jack Muir is living in. I don't want to call it Albany. What will I call it? And we agreed that there was a choice of two, kinkanup or kinjaling, and we all agreed that because kinkanup had been the first recorded name, nobody quite knows its origins. But we went with kinkanup, and then everything else I wrote that referenced Noongars, Noongar culture, Noongar names, whatever, I ran that again by my friends, because I am particularly sensitive to those wounds.
Mm.
In the original when we got to a point where we had a manuscript, in the acknowledgements I'd recorded the names of my closest friends and helpers, and they asked for their names to be removed, so I removed them.
Mm.
and just made a general thank you, because they didn't want to they felt that, because even though I feel we've all done the right thing, of course there is the possibility that somebody from the community will complain about something.
Yeah.
There is that possibility. So, but I think it's a sensitivity that I hold deep.
I can tell that, you know, obviously there's been a lot of sensitivity, there's been a lot of research, you've drawn on your own life. I wonder if it's possible at all for the writer to create something that's completely beyond themselves and their experience. So do you think the writer is always in the book? And Georgia, to what extent is the editor always visible in the book?
I think it's really problematic if the editor is visible. And I say that from when I've noticed the visible editor, and that's usually because there's errors that are leaping out, or there's a sense of, oh, it's slowed right down here, or why. I don't see that as the author's inverted commas fault per se, but that the editor wasn't doing their job well enough. So I think the editor needs to have the author's back.
Yeah.
And if they don't, that's problematic. And therefore, the editor should always be invisible. Mm. And I think an editor and a writer is a particular kind of alchemy. So one editor and one writer would make a different book to a different editor and the same writer.
Mm.
But even so, the editor should be invisible.
Well, I think we've come to the end of our chat.
No, I was just getting
getting started. We do, however, still have time, John, if you would read an excerpt from Return Ticket for us. So
excellent.
Can you tell me what you're going to read and what page it's on, so people at home can read along?
I'm going to read what I was told to read.
Oh, that's good.
I'm going to read the so-called, it was a very interesting question. Somebody, I was showed the book to somebody the other day, and he flicked through. He said, hang on a second, these numbers all over the place. And then he realised, oh, he said, so you've got a chapter heading and then one and two, that's the second part of the chapter. I said, that's right. So I'm going to read number two, that's the second part of the first chapter.
Okay.
And it's on page 10.
Thank you very much.
Here we go. Almost 50 years ago, I climbed on board the Fair Star in Fremantle. The Jack Muir of 1972 had only recently left a family business and a secure future. There was something brewing in him then, and some of it still brews today, and still much of that earlier version remains a mystery. I often think of him in the third person, someone I once knew, almost knew well enough to challenge, to question. young Jack broke from his family, told them to leave him alone, not to try and contact him, that he might be gone years. "Not to worry," he said. "It's not about you. It's me." But it was, he thought, about them and their culture, their town, their lack, its lack. It seemed to him that everyone he knew was unfinished, incomplete, and he wanted completion. He had begun to turn away from everything he'd ever learnt, everyone he knew or had ever known. "There's something going on out there," he said, "and I have to find out about it and work out how I fit in." Looking back through his journals, I read the writing of an arrogant, self-absorbed young man, very much of his time. He was also adventurous and random, and this makes him interesting, worthy of my attention. And, of course, whoever he was someone who had a dramatic impact on my life. The first port of call for that ship was Durban, South Africa, 10 days away from Fremantle. My immediate intentions were unclear to me, but although my ticket destination was Southampton, England, I never made it.
That was John Dowse reading from his book Return Ticket. You can find it at fremantlepress.com.au and all good bookstores. John and Georgia, thank you so much for our chat today.
Thanks.
A pleasure, thank you.
If you enjoyed today's chat, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. My name's Rebecca Hickey, and I've been your host today. As the winner of the 2019 Fogarty Literary Award, I'll be talking to the wonderful people of Frio Press, writers and editors alike, until my book, The History of Mischief, is released in September. Join me next time as we explore the world of publishing with those in the know.